My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as education coordinator. Another good crowd in Fireside this morning.
Yes.
Great. Thank you for turning out. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jen Blacka from San Francisco State University. Jen teaches about waste reduction, and she's going to help us think about zero waste, which is like somewhat mind-boggling for me, but it's going to be fun to have her help us think through that. So, and Jen was a member of the Holden Winter Community in 1992.
Yeah, 92, 93.
So, mm-hmm. Welcome back. We're so happy to have you here. Thank you.
Winter Community.
Yeah, so I was, thank you. And thanks everybody for coming. Yeah, being on teaching staff here is kind of a little dream come true because I was here in my, you know, early 20s, right out of college, working in the kitchen. And I looked at the teaching staff and I thought, someday when I'm a middle-aged grown-up, I want to come back and be on teaching staff. And look, it happened. Welcome to the class. I've been able to ponder it a few months more since we sent in our initial descriptions, and the summer theme of Fear Not has sort of shaped the direction of the session, and shifted the name of the class a little bit from Zero Waste, which is really a topic, but an inspiration to Waste Not, Fear Not. You know, we all know the old saying, waste not, want not. But here we can think about, this is really should be a hopeful session. We will look at the problem of waste and some of the problems associated with our garbage and wasting habits. But really it's forward looking, and I think hopeful for what we could be doing instead and what we could all do when we go home and transform our communities into not wasting communities and societies and economies, but regenerative and more life-giving and healthful communities. So the description on the boards has the same description for all 3 days, but it actually is three different sessions. Today will be sort of the conceptual overview. And then Wednesday will be about plastics in particular, which is a very particular problem that a lot of us are worried about, plastics in the oceans and toxicity of plastic and plastic in the water and plastic bottles. So we'll talk all about plastic on Wednesday, problems and solutions. And Friday will be about food waste and organic waste and compost and how we can prevent food waste, make better use of our food resources, and then get it back to the soil when, you know, when we're done. So Wednesday's plastics, Friday's organics and food waste. But today is sort of the brain shifting, think differently about our stuff and kind of open our eyes and like, we don't have to think about it the same way we have been thinking about it that has got us into a lot of trouble. So that's today. So, To start with, I think we'll spend the first half hour, we have an hour, 90 minutes, so we'll spend about the first 30 minutes really introducing why is garbage and wasting a problem? What are the big picture situation of our current situation of garbage? And then the last hour will be this sort of solution-oriented thing. So I'd like to start by just asking you, I mean, people come from different parts of the country, rural, urban, different settings, different places. I'd like to know, what are your concerns? What are your fears? What are your frustrations or questions currently about garbage or wasting or trash or garbage pollution or anything like that? I'd kind of like to take those down to know where you're at and hopefully address a lot of those.
So I've lived near you in Davis, and we've had a really successful town recycling program for many years.
Mm-hmm.
We understand that China's changing the rules
Correct.
Of what they will take, and so we think we're not going to be able to recycle all the things that we have been. Is there anything we can do to change China's mind.
Okay, so...
Or develop ways to handle it in this country?
Right, okay, so China recycling ban, what to do?
It's because of the rate of contaminants was higher than 5%. It affected Portland, Oregon, too.
Well, the whole West Coast is sort of in a crisis. So for people who haven't heard, for the last 20 years, China has taken a huge volume of our collected up used materials, and we've shipped them to China, and they make them into new things, and then they ship them back for us to buy as stuff. In some way, it's super efficient because thousands of container ships come over with stuff for us to buy, and they go back empty. And so the shipping is free and kind of useful. And a lot of our manufacturing has declined over decades. And so, you know, in some ways, that's made a lot of sense. But China, for a variety of reasons, doesn't want to be the world's garbage dump kind of thing. And so as of January 1st, 2018, they have a new law called the National Sword. And it's like, keep your garbage out. Their consumer society has sort of come up enough that they make enough of their own trash that they have to recycle that, and so they don't need everybody else's. And they didn't want sort of the bad look of being the trash dump. So cities all over the West Coast, at least, that had been shipping to China are now, since January 1st, scrambling to find other markets for all the stuff that they've gathered up, because places have successful recycling programs of gathering and sorting and baling, and now it's all standing on docks with nowhere to go. So that's the context of that.
Yeah. I can say along that same line, in our community, when I'm finding they're charging me $5 to recycle now, where it used to be free. So a lot of my friends are saying, well, I'm not going to pay $5 to recycle. So
pay to recycle? Okay.
So I got one up here.
Yeah.
So apparently beginning with the tearful Indian standing on the polluted riverbanks, manufacturers have lobbied and created associations that have pointed the finger of responsibility on the end user to avoid their responsibility.
And there's the end of class. Yeah. Yes. We don't so much have a collection problem as we have a production problem. Producers, yeah, irresponsible. What you're referring to is Keep America Beautiful, or KAB. This organization actually started when they started making the transition from reusable and washable glass bottles. I don't know how many people remember. You used to take your used bottles back to the grocery store, and they'd get picked up, washed, sanitized, refilled with beer and soda pop, and then they'd come back again, and bottles got to be used 10, 20 times before they got melted down and made into new bottles. But when did that start changing? Yeah, so the first transition to single-use disposables started in the 50s, and in fact, it just went to thinner glass first. They didn't have plastic bottles yet, but they started going from kind of thick, heavy glass to thinner glass, and they didn't want them back. And, when the grocery stores didn't take them back, the problem of people just kind of throwing them by the roadside started. And the first bottle bill actually started in Vermont in 1953 because farmers' cows were eating glass bottles that had been thrown into like hay piles. And so the farmers of Vermont got the first bottle bill in the country passed in the early 50s and tried to say, we can't have these glass bottles just being thrown around. You have to take them back like you have been. This is going to be a problem. And the bottle and package industry and the beverage industries got together and were like, we don't want them back. We're making more money. We don't want to deal with picking them up and washing them and refilling them. It's a pain in the neck. If we do single use and just send them out and don't get them back, we make more money. So they formed Keep America Beautiful as a public service campaign organization and beautification. So for the last 60 years, they've run flower planting in the spring. They give away millions and millions of dollars every year to towns to do town cleanup and beautification. You can plant flowers and put trash cans everywhere and all these slogans like, put litter in its place, or don't mess with Texas. We're all paid for by Keep America Beautiful, which was a bottle and beverage industry group fronting as this green beautification group. And they talked us into blaming individual litter bugs. They invented the name litter bug to divert our view from their production of millions and millions and millions and millions and billions and billions of single-use, throwaway packaging, and blame ourselves. And so that 1971, The Crying Indian is one of the most famous PSA commercials ever, so people who weren't alive at that time, it's one clip I didn't download. It was this mind, heart-wrenching ad at the time. It shows this river and this supposedly Native American guy in a canoe going along with braids, and he's going, and there's like McDonald's bags and bottles and junk floating by, and he looks up and he sees this big polluting factory, and the voiceover says, some people have a deep abiding respect for the natural environment and some people don't. And a car drives by right then, and somebody throws a big bag of trash out the car window, and it lands at the guy's feet, and he looks up and he has a tear fall from his solemn face. And it was very effective to get people to feel really bad about littering. It was one of the most powerful commercials ever made at that point. And everybody who saw it remembers it. One of the things was the guy who played that was actually Sicilian. Iron Eyes Cody. And it was paid for by the beverage and packaging industry to blame the... So it made it individualized. Some people care about nature and some people don't. Don't be one of the litter bugs. But what the whole thing was diverting our attention from the producers. Don't look over here. We're just making 10 billion bottles a day and throwing them into the world. You're bad if you don't put it in the trash. Put litter in its place, which was a trash can, which was destined for the landfill. That's the correct thing to do as an individual. You're a good person if you put it in the landfill. But it was a total smokescreen so that no more bottle bills got passed, because they were really worried. Six states passed bottle bills, and they were like, no. So while they got Keep America Beautiful going, they also made this big phalanx of lobbyists and lawyers, and they have prevented bottle bills passing in every other state since then. The last one passed in the 70s. And no place, no matter how hard they've tried, been able to get another bottle bill passed because of the packaging lobbyists.
Is the suggestion that we have no responsibility in all of this?
No. No.
That's the way it's coming across.
Oh. I don't mean to say that we have no responsibility, but people should be aware that we've been told that it's entirely our responsibility. And there's been a hundreds of millions of dollars campaign for the last 70 years to teach us that. And so to just take the curtain away and go like, do producers have any responsibility? Is kind of like, oh, can people just make anything they want and send it out in the world and make other people clean it up? Okay, so I've seen a couple hands already. So you Hen.
I thought that I would just segue on that because I'm here as having been a member of many green teams, so recognizing the problem but not finding the right voice to influence or inform, or you know, how do we get into the people, the politics, the policy, or whatever, influence the change?
Okay. I forgot I'm still taking down initial comments. I got all worked up. Yeah.
One more initial comment. I've become more aware of plastics pollution in the past year, and I assume maybe on Wednesday you'll deal with some of the solutions to that issue. That's an interest to me.
Yes. Plastics. Yeah. We're going to spend all of Wednesday specifically on plastics. So we'll touch on that today. But if you want a plastics intensive, then Wednesday's your day. Yeah.
I have friends who were aware of tap water actually being really drinkable in this country. And so this is something I hate to be the sanctimonious environmentalist, but I don't understand bottled water. How much bottled water there is purchased and drink, I understand it's convenient, but it really creates a lot of waste. And we have perfectly good water to drink from the tap.
Yeah. Unless, except in Flint, and a few places like it. Yeah, or maybe not, but...
That's a problem, too.
But we spend a lot of money on bottled water, and if we spent that amount on our water infrastructure.
Who wants to spend the money probably to get drink of it?
Yeah.
Well, and the bottled water then has been a, we don't have to have good municipal water, you can just buy bottled water, so I think that's another disturbing connection.
Yes, yes.
Deflects from responsible public works.
Public, yeah. Public resource, sort of.
Yeah. So I just had a question about what you were talking about before, in terms of the packaging market lobby, in terms of not reusing, like if bottles are recycled, how do they make more, like they're not washing, and this
no.
just goes into recycling, do they lose, but they don't make money? I mean, like why do they?
They're fine with recycling.
Okay.
They don't want to wash them.
Oh, okay. So bottle bills are about
well, so well, yeah. Okay. This is okay. So bottle bills. I have to think for a second. Relationship with recycling.
Is it the severe recycling that consumers can take more, so they're less likely to buy it because they're like, oh, I have to pay 5 more cents for it. Is that kind of what they don't like? Or?
I have to let that percolate for a second. I'm like on a different brain, so I have to think. But that's a good question. I'll not forget that. Okay. Yeah.
So two things more on a practical matter.
What do we do with block foam, for example? What do we do with what?
Block foam?
Yeah. Oh, like styrofoam?
Yeah, sometimes you have to buy something.
How do you get rid of the packaging?
What do you do with that? Are these thin plastic pieces that you can't, that recyclers won't pay, and they just go to landfills? Is there an alternative to do with that?
No.
Well, and that's just interesting how that is kind of like our problem to figure that out, isn't it? It's like, exactly. Man, I have to figure out what to do with that foam.
So in my community, they do recycle block foam, but you have to take it to...
It's a pretty specialized thing because what you need is a machine. You have to get enough styrofoam or block foam. You could get a room this size full, and then they have to have a machine that squishes it down and it comes out to be about this big because it's so much air. And so if you were to even the gathering of it up, think of all the car trips or truck trips that came to deliver 99% air to this central location. So you have to think about, is the fuel worth it to recycle this block of air with this much plastic in it? So then you get it all in room, you have a machine that uses energy to squish it down, and then you take, you know, a few years to gather that all up, and then you load it on one truck, and then you can take it to someplace and then melt it down and make something new plastic out of it. But is it very good quality? What type of plastic is it? Is it worth it? And so when you get an entire truckload of squished down old styrofoam that has already taken like many different vehicle loads to bring it to a central location and then squish it down, it's worth like $20 or something of materials. So almost every type of plastic is technically recyclable. You could recycle it in a lab or on a bench or whatever, but the efficiency of finding all the same type, because you can't just throw it all in one vat and melt it down together. So this is a different kind of plastic than this is a different kind than this foamy, you know, fiber thing that's on the inside. You'd have to pick those apart and get truckloads of just the caps, you know, and then get them to somewhere that can melt down just the caps. So if you need to like mail this somewhere to come together with a million other caps and then mail this somewhere else, or if you're gonna drive there, you know, and who's gonna drive in which truck? And then the diesel spent to drive the trucks full of mostly air, and then you melt it down in the end and it's worth like $20 worth of resin. It's technically recyclable, but it's not feasibly recyclable, or it's not sensibly recyclable, it's not efficiently recyclable. It takes more energy to bother to do it than it takes to just chuck it in the landfill and get another one. So one of the things that we're going to talk about is we have been tasked with a lot of like mental and emotional labor trying to figure out what to do with everything. Like in my classes on garbage, I have a lot of students like who are really sincere, and I bet every, you know, we're holding tight people. We're like sorting, and what do I do with my dental floss? You know, and so you're like, okay, is it made out of, you know, cotton with wax? Now, does that go in the cotton, or is it fiberglass, you know, or not fiber, you know, is it like, is it a plastic thread? What do I do with this? And beer bottle caps, well, they're metal, but they have like a little plastic thing inside. Do I have to like pry it out? Like, this is our job now, you know, that all of us have to individually figure out how we're going to handle our bottle caps. It's so much time and energy and whatever. It's like, if somebody could figure out a better bottle cap that you could throw in the compost, for example, that would solve a billion people's bottle cap anxiety, you know, and our dental floss anxiety and our, like, what am I going to do with this shoelace that's... Like, what was it made of? Is it mixed fibers, or is it like the energy and like psychic burden of all of us on the far end of the whole process, trying to figure out what's the most responsible way to dispose of it, is so far downstream. I'm going to encourage us to kind of like get upstream and like have a billion people not have to each individually try to figure that out.
If this is so difficult to get rid of not find a way to recycle, why produce them?
Preach!
In fact, why not use a blackboard that's usable and doesn't require recycling?
I haven't said anything, Holden, but in my own classroom, I went away one summer and my chalk was gone, and they gave me all the, in the last, you know, 10 years of teaching, I've probably gone through 200 of these. Yeah. Every single one of them into the trash. I could have used, you know, a box of chalk. I'm told in my classroom it's because of breathing, like students with asthma and stuff. Okay, okay. But could we figure out a...
But yet the solvent that is as toxic as the chalk dust.
Sorry. No, I am so with you. We need to get upstream and prevent, like, why are we making things that are impossible to deal with downstream? And it's causing all of us to like spend our life energy trying to figure out what to do with these little things, what to do with our styrofoam. It's like, there shouldn't be styrofoam. Like, can't we come up with something else? And in fact, on Wednesday, I'll show you like an alternative to styrofoam that's like so great and easy, and it's here, and we could convert it all right away. So go home and make a not styrofoam factory, and it'll be great. So there are alternatives coming up. So that's a hopeful thing. Yes.
So we started talking after the orientation here at Holden about preparing for those who will come after us.
Mm-hmm.
And started thinking about like cobalt in our cell phones and technology.
Yeah.
And both how is that impacting people in Africa, as well as then how are we recycling it or disposing of it here. But then additionally, I know that people have tried certain things. Like you think about car tire, recycled car tires.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, how they started making playgrounds out of them, only to find that down the road there are children who are developing leukemia or leukemia-type symptoms from things like that.
Yeah.
So then how do we think generations
ahead?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned cobalt.
Yeah, I think what he means is coltan.
Oh, okay.
So coltan is a... correct me if I'm wrong, but I think coltan is that they have to use tiny little amounts in all of our electronic devices and our phones and stuff, and it's mined especially in Congo, and it's mostly child miners. Something like a third of children in the Congo don't go to school because they're mining coltan for our electronic devices. C-O-L-T-A-N. You think it's cobalt?
Yeah, cobalt, the element cobalt. Yeah. It goes into...
Maybe the ore is the name that...
And cobalt. Okay, we'll have to look that up. I thought there was a thing called coltan that they're mining, and it's going in. It could both, but so there are these tiny little elemental things that are going in our electronics, and so another. Okay, so other initial.
So what Brad was saying made me think just about the things about race and economy and the whole issue of waste. We live in a rapidly gentrifying neighborhood where I'm not even kidding when I say like
next to each other on one street, there's like a store where, I mean, with my income, I could go into this adorable new store that opened up 2 years ago and buy like an all stainless steel lunch kit, you know, and it's like reusable and stuff like that, and it costs like $38. And my neighbors, who I notice are brown skinned, shop at the dollar store next door where they're buying the same kinds of goods that are made out of plastic, that are disposable, because that's what they can afford on their income. And like, I feel like the sustainable life is, it outprices people. Like, most of my neighbors can't do this. And I have my own like love affair with Costco that I would like to somehow get over. But I mean, and like Costco, like organic apples are affordable from Costco, but they come in that like where every apple has like its own package. But like, how can I judge folks who can't go to the farmer's market with their organic cotton mesh bag and like, you know what I mean? Like, it's spendy to do that. And how are we gonna bring everybody along? So that's,
great question. Yeah, so when like being green or being sustainable is expensive to do, so there's a justice and disparity question. Another sort of environmental justice question related to these garbage issues is generally the waste burden falls on marginalized communities, whether that's far away, like our plastics and electronics recycling, you know, has gone to China or goes to Bangladesh or goes to Nigeria or goes to places where very poor people are burning them in their backyards to get the, you know, precious metals out and to extract little parts that they can sell for a living, and they're totally getting poisoned. And the people who are spending their childhoods mining for materials to go into our goods, and even to the level of where do we site incinerators, where do we site landfills, they're generally not in wealthy communities. They're in places where people don't have a lot of political power to resist them. Sometimes communities want them because there are jobs associated with landfills and incinerators. But there's also a lot of like trucks going by, hundreds of trucks a day, and the pollution from the trucks going by usually increases the you know, health problems, asthma, et cetera, in the local communities. You know, there can be air quality problems and water quality problems and stuff. So, and so when we talk about environmental justice, probably a lot of people are familiar with this, but it's the idea that environmental benefits and hazards, or goods and bads, are unequally distributed. You know, in some places we get the cool, you know, watches and iPads and stuff, and in other places they get polluted from them. You know, in some places we have the convenience of buying stuff that is single-use plastic, and in other places where it's the middle of the ocean and other species like eating plastic that's in the ocean, or other places where it's being incinerated and they're breathing it, that the benefits and hazards of a thing aren't just, or you know, evenly distributed. Yeah.
What about electronic items like cell phones and kind of engineered obsolescence?
Yeah. Yeah. Engineered obsolescence or planned obsolescence. That is, you know, you buy the shiny new thing and a year or two later it's like it barely works. It's time to get another one. Everything's upgraded. It's running so slowly. What are you supposed to do with it? Is there any good thing to do with it? And it's pretty grim right now. There are some I'm not sure I'll get back to it very much, so I'll just say briefly, look for a program called eStewards in your community. eStewards is a third-party certification program so that e-waste recycler is monitored for decent practices. If it's an eStewards certified electronics recycling program, they won't ship it overseas, won't incinerate it, and won't use prison labor. And, for example, the city of San Francisco contracts with an eStewards certified electronics recycler. So you know if you hand your electronics over to the city recycling group, it'll be dismantled reasonably. But a lot of sort of other places where it says, like, recycle your e-waste, or, you know, your electronics here, just throw it in this thing, we'll handle it, You have no idea. You know, it could end up in a pretty rough place. Yeah.
And P.S. on that, I think we are spoiled. We're a throwaway society. I'm thinking back, we used to get pens and buy refills. Now we just buy those plastic ones and throw them away. And do we take things to get them repaired anymore? No, we just go out and buy another appliance.
Yeah. And we're sort of, you know, we're told that, well, it's so convenient and this is like a fun throwaway lifestyle. But a lot of people have actually felt a lot of resistance to it, but you can't even get repairable things. I mean, if you've taken things to try to get them repaired, your toaster breaks or your sewing machine breaks, and where is the repair shop? Who's doing that for a living? And it costs more to get it repaired than it does to get a new one. So I find a number of people still get shoes repaired, and that's about the only thing. You know, we took a vacuum cleaner to get it repaired, and the vacuum repair guy was like, don't bother, buy a new one. We're like, are you planning to put your business out of business? You know, but, okay, so great. So you guys are already, I mean, it takes me most of the semester to get my students like as thinking already as you guys are coming in with. So we'll just like leap ahead. So, a lot of the issues that we're talking about, we can start thinking about them in terms of the materials economy. How many people have heard that term? Okay, materials economy. So the current model of a materials economy that we have, that we're operating on, is a linear materials economy. That is, from extraction to production, to distribution, consumption, and disposal. Disposal. This is sort of the track that our material goods follow. You mine lumber, you log, you grow, you know, crops, you dig things out, you chop them down, you pull them out of the ocean, you like extract stuff from the earth, and then you take it to a factory and you make it into something, and then you put it on a ship or a truck or a train or a something, and you get it to a store, and then people buy it, use it, and then dispose of it. And this is sort of this throughput system that we've developed, especially in the 20th century, thanks to the benefits of fossil fuel. It's been really a fun party to like extract things, make them into stuff, use them once and throw them away. And we got really good at building landfills, and it became a slick process. Especially post-World War II, 50s to 70s is sometimes called the golden age of waste. It was just like this limitless, after the Depression when nobody could afford to buy anything, and after the war when all the resources were put toward the war effort, there was all this like, they call it, you know, like repressed consumer desire. And people came back, the GI Bill, joined the middle class, and everybody was like, woo, I can buy a little house and a car and a, you know, and a dishwasher and a toaster and an iron and a coffee pot and Hungry Man dinners and a lawnmower and a trimmer and a, you know, like, and then your house got full. And then sort of by the late 50s, the manufacturers noticed that there was this sort of plateau. And they were like, we'll buy another fridge. And people are like, I got one. Well, how about another washing machine? I've got one. Works great. Thanks. Well, who's going to buy another washing machine? Like, everybody had one of everything. And so the manufacturers in the late 50s were freaking out, and they had to figure out how they were going to keep up the demand. So one of the advertising things was, well, don't you need also a fridge in your garage to keep your extra beer, you know, and your, and don't you need two cars because now you can have two adults who drive, and don't you need a cabin with like another set of stuff, and don't you need, you know, and so that kind of kept up the demand a little bit. That's, but only a certain amount. That helped a little bit. Then they also had to figure out, we have to make stuff break faster, because they were building these tanks of appliances and stuff. You know, if anybody had a fridge or a water heater that is like 50 years old, 70 years old, still running, made out of steel, Nothing will kill it. Well, it's not like that anymore. If you go to Home Depot and try to buy a water heater now, it's like good, better, and best is like a 3-year guarantee, a 5-year guarantee, and an 8-year guarantee. Like, that water heater isn't planning to last 70 years. They had to make stuff actually break faster so that people would have to buy a second one and a third one and not have toasters that lasted forever. They also had to make new styles. You know, cars used to be all black, and then they figured out, oh, we got to make the 1958 model different from the 57 and 59, different from 58. We have to change colors, have tail fins, no tail fins, different fronts, different colors, different styles, so you could see how old they were, so that you would start go, oh man, look, the next door neighbors have a new car, and ours is 5 years old, and theirs looks so shiny, and ours kind of is the dumb round kind, and theirs is all like pointy on the corners. So, so they figured out, so these are two things called planned obsolescence is make it break or make your electronics become obsolete in it so that you have to replace them. And perceived obsolescence is basically style. Is basically style. Changing styles so that you're like, oh, well, I have this thing, but now it looks dumb because everybody has a newer one. So, but this is this sort of mid-century linear plan to make us, not to make it, you know, to rev the economy up. It was seen as like the more making and buying and making and buying and making and buying, the better. It grows the economy. And it's economic growth. And what happens after here, disposal is just sort of like an afterthought. We'll just big holes in the ground and we'll get these compactor trucks and throw all your junk in there. We'll pick it up from the street corner or, you know, in front of your house. We'll pick it up, smash it, and throw it in a hole in the ground, and then buy more stuff. Don't worry about it, we'll just take it away. And it was very cheap. Landfilling was cheap. The trucks took it away. You didn't have to think about it. But in more recent decades, we've started to realize that this system is unsustainable. You can't run a linear system on a finite planet forever. The natural world doesn't work in a linear system, it works in a circular system, right? So I think I said in a little blurb, like plants grow, they drop their leaves, the leaves fall on the ground, they don't have to go to a landfill, you know, they go back in the earth and they come up as more plants. There's like this circle, right? Or the plant grows up and an animal eats it and the animal poops and the poop goes back in the ground, or the animal eats it, the animal dies. Are there squirrel bodies this high in piles out there? No, they go away because other things eat them and then they poop and then they die and they fall over and they rot and they go back in the ground and then it grows more trees. Like, there's no waste. Or if there's waste, the waste becomes food for another organism. And so in nature, you have this circular system where the waste of one organism becomes the food of another organism. There's no linear thing, that, like, nature doesn't need a landfill. Only we need a landfill because we made stuff that doesn't just go back in the cycle. So the big talk in sort of this zero waste field is now about circular economies, and that what we have to do is revise our materials economy from being a linear system to a circular system. We have to get from grabbing stuff out of the earth and putting it back in a hole or incinerating it and make things that we can use over and over and over and over, or put back in the ground and grow again and put back in the ground and grow again. So how are we going to do that, and what would that look like? So why isn't that possible right now? We have a couple of hindrances going on. Okay, I need like 5 whiteboards. So currently, okay, one thing we need to know about is, so if this is the total, this is 100% of your city's, your town's garbage, or what we call municipal solid waste, MSW. So this is all the garbage that homes and businesses throw out on the street that they put into cans and they get collected. In the United States, currently, do you know what percentage of all the United States municipal solid waste goes to landfill or incineration? We're actually better than that, 66. We've improved very much. So about 66% of the U.S. municipal solid waste goes to landfill or incinerator. And the other 34%, where is that going if it's not going to the landfill?
Are you counting composting and recycling?
Yes, compost and recycling. So 34% of the total stuff that people put out on their front, you know, sidewalk is going to either composting or recycling. And that has gone up a lot. In 1960, it was 6%. So over the last 50 years, more and more municipalities are collecting recycling, and some have started municipal composting. So we are diverting about a third of our solid waste stream. That's way better than 6%. This is called the diversion rate. So for example, in California, so I teach at San Francisco State University. In California, the state legislature passed a bill about 20 years ago saying by 1995, every municipality in the state has to get to 25% diversion. San Francisco already had 25, and so San Francisco was like, we can't let the rest of the state catch up with us. By that time, we're going to get to 50% diversion rate. The state passed another bill that said by 2000, everybody has to get to 50% diversion rate. Every municipality in the state of California has to get 50% diversion by 2000. San Francisco was like, we're going to get to 75. We have to be greener than everybody else. And they did. By 2000, San Francisco got to 75% diversion. And then the state passed another thing that said by 2020, everybody in the state has to get to 75. They're like, well, if San Francisco can do it, so can Modesto. Come on. You know, so every municipality in the state is mandated to get to 75% diversion rate. That is 25% to landfill and 75% somewhere else, which is either composting or recycling, by 2020. San Francisco said, we're going to do 100%. Don't know how we're going to do that, but we can't let everybody else catch up with us. So we're going to have 100% diversion, and that equals zero waste to landfill by 2020. They're not going to make it. But I said, they're not going to make it. But by setting that goal, they have pushed themselves to get as close as they can to figure out, like, what gets in the way of zero waste? What's in the way?
How do they enforce that? What are the consequences of municipalities not reaching these goals? They can mandate it, but I don't understand what that means. You're going to do this, and if they don't do it, it's like, oh, well, I guess you didn't do it.
No, there are fines.
It's a state, the enforcement for the municipalities, I mean, it's strict. And they're really, I think it's fines and...
So the state government fines the city governments?
Yeah.
To transfer money from the city? Okay, I got it.
In the city of Davis, we're very environmentally conscious. Uh-huh. Maybe not as much as San Francisco. your building permit will not be approved if you don't have certain criteria. A certain amount of fly ash in the concrete, for example. You have to demonstrate that you've diverted building material that you're turning down.
So that's a way that the city... tries to reach the city's goals within the city. So they're like, okay, builders, you have to do this. Schools, you have to do that. Residents, you have to do this. Restaurants, you have to do that. So that the city can meet its 75% goal.
Okay, so in that case, it's a building permit, I think I heard.
From the city to the builders.
Yeah, so that's one of the ways to enforce.
Yeah, but that's not being enforced from the state. The state is saying, city, you have to get 75%. We're not telling you how. City, you got to get to 75%. Work in your local place to figure that out. Are you having a lot of construction and demolition debris? Do you have a lot of yard waste? Do you have a lot of restaurants? Do you have a lot of manufacturing debris? Like, what's your problem? You figure it out locally, but you got to get to 75. And so then the local places do different incentives and taxes and rules and permits and regulations to reach that in their locale.
So I'm one of those Davis folks. Uh-huh. And I worked for the University of California at Davis, and when they opened the new athletic stadium, they touted it as being the most environmentally conscious stadium that is a 100% recyclable stadium. And what we learned in using the stadium over the course of time was that they ran into the same issue that you mentioned with San Francisco, is like there's just some items you just can't recycle. Didn't you know that Snickers candy bar wrappers don't recycle, you know? Mm-hmm. And so what ended up happening was people just took it and threw it away somewhere else. So it was like, and the University of California at Davis has its own waste management system. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to be ultra environmentally conscious because of, in part, pressure from their faculty, only to discover that really all they were doing was redirecting the stuff that they couldn't deal with.
Right, so this is the limitation. Okay, so that extraction, production, distribution, consumption, disposal. If we focus entirely on how do we dispose of this Snickers wrapper? How are we going to sort better? It's going to be really hard to solve the problem by looking at this portion. We have to be back here. Like, why are Snickers wrappers made out of a thing that you can't recycle? You know? So we're going to have to, like, back it up. But we can't figure out, the way that we figure out that the Snickers wrapper is a problem is by trying to set the bar and say, we're going to recycle everything. And then we go, like, Snickers wrappers, diapers, Barbie dolls. Like, what are the things left? Like, what's the remnant that's...
The other thing they ran into was, so they wouldn't purchase items that couldn't be recycled and sell them in the stadium. So then people started bringing them in.
Wow.
So how do you... Yeah.
Well, which is kind of like a Holden Village situation, right? Like...
While you're having in the stadium, it's wrapped in paper now. Wonderful wax paper. And they even have a place for it so they can compost it. But then, you know, the little kid that runs up and goes, I don't like that stuff. Mom pulls out of her pocket purse, dad pulls out, you know, mm-hmm. here's what you like, and then you can't recycle it. And, yeah.
You do, by doing things like that, though, you do get a big bulk of the stuff handled. So, like you were asking about enforcement. So, you know, with sort of environmental behavior change, there's this section of people who are like the eager beavers, who are early adopters, and they want to do, and they'll like pay extra to do the right thing. Like, we, you know, we carry our own, we sewed our own muslin bags that we, then we grow our own wheat in the backyard, and we're like, they're like trying really hard, right? And those, you don't have to do any, they'll pay extra to do the right thing. And then there's people who will do the right thing if you make it easy. Right, or not do the right thing, but like do the desired behavior if you make it easy. And then there's people who will do the desired behavior if you give them incentive. Like, you will save money if you, you know, we'll charge you extra for this bag, but you can get 5 cents off if you use this bag. You know, you can build incentives into your garbage bill. So for a long time in San Francisco, we got these three cans. We have landfill, recycling, and compost cans. And for now 10 or 15 years, you get charged for the landfill can and not for the other two. And so it incentivized. And so the less that you put in your landfill can, you can get a smaller and smaller and smaller one until your landfill can almost disappears. So the big one costs, you know, $150 every 2 months. This one costs $90 every 2 months. This one costs $60 every 2 months. There's a little one that costs $40 every 2 months. And meanwhile, the more you're like, well, that could go in the compost. That could go in recycling. All I have in here is, you know, plastic bags and wipes. And, like, it's not very much in my trash. So you can build an incentive. So that takes care of people who, if you give them incentive, they'll do the behavior change that you want. And then there's reluctant people, and they respond to sticks, right? So these are carrots, and then there's sticks. Like, eventually, after you give them all these other options, then you, like, and then there will be fines. But you give them a few years to, like, opt into the behavior change. Eventually, in San Francisco is at this point now, there's bin inspectors. They can walk down the street and look in people's bins, and if they're not sorted properly, you get a door hanger that says, we noticed that you're putting orange peels in your landfill bin. The corrective action is to put them in your landfill or your compost bin. We'll check back. And if they, like three times, they find that the wrong thing's in the wrong thing, then you start getting fines. It's more for businesses right now, like restaurants, because there's huge volumes. So if a restaurant is putting its food waste in the landfill bin, they start to get fined. Because now these three bins are mandatory, but it's been over the course of a decade, they've kind of had the opportunity. And then, you know what, there is a remnant of people who won't do it no matter what. You can find them, you can give them a fair opportunity, you can educate them, you can plead, you can show up and have like, you know, one-on-one meetings with the head of San Francisco Recycling, and they're like, I hate you people. You know, like, I want to do what I want to do. I don't, you're like forcing this down my throat. I like to throw my food waste in the landfill, and I'm just not going to. And you know what? Just move on, because they're only accounting for this much. You have solved like 93% of the problem. You could spend all the rest of your energy for the next 20 years trying to convince that person to put their thing in the right thing, and they hate you. You know, just go on to the next project. Like, now work on banning styrofoam, or inventing an alternative to styrofoam, or, you know, getting, you know, do some other thing. But like, you've gotten the giant bulk of people doing the thing through these other means, and like, you could waste your energy on that last remnant, but, you know, they'll go away one or another eventually, but you've done this big bulk of change. Yeah. There is a federal law from the 70s called the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, and it does have a mandate for states to have an integrated waste management plan, and the states, all states should be doing some amount of diversion from landfills and recycling, but states have a lot of leeway to bump it up.
Or down.
Or down. Okay, so, yes.
I've been listening to you, and I'm looking at all these things, and I think something's missing.
Yeah.
I don't know if some people might call it a spiritual value or ethics, or it's just the materialism and consumerism of our culture.
Yeah.
Because we can take care of our trash and recycle and develop new things, but that kind of overrides a lot of why we have so much stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, and we've, you know, we've been experimenting for the better part of a century now with, does that make us happy?
Yeah. Right, and it does, the research.
The research seems to say there's a certain base level of material comfort.
Absolutely.
You know, of sort of like a place to sleep and food to eat and clean water and et cetera, that makes sort of life less stressful. And then as you go up and up and up, the happiness quotient does not rise.
Sorry, but I think that's an excellent comment, because all the things I see up here, I think that's the one thing that we can control. Everything else, we have to convince somebody else to do something. And that's the one thing that we can do it right now. We don't have to do anything. We can do that right now if we want to. So I think that's a very good comment.
Great.
And I think human behavior forces, like restaurants, are throwing away tons of perfectly fine food because somebody has so much on their plate they can't eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not taking it home. They're simply saying, throw it away. And that affects the whole world in general.
Yeah, we've gotten into very wasteful habits. Yeah. Wait, somebody who hasn't said something before.
And I just wonder, you know, culturally, as you look around the world, where, you know, Scandinavia is ahead of us on a lot of this.
Yeah.
EU is also probably.
Yeah. We do have the highest sort of throughput per person.
Yeah.
However, I mean, one of the concerns about this garbage problem in it globally is that as people get more wealth, people enjoy material stuff. And so, you know, we're seeing in China and India, you know, as more people like sort of enter the middle class and have jobs, they're like, I can get a motorbike, I can get a refrigerator, I can eat beef, I can buy extra clothes and throw them away, I can, buy plastic pens and throw them away. And there's the model from the US is attractive. I mean, it's kind of like the 50s when people had gone through the Depression and the war, and then suddenly there was this like smorgasbord of material comforts, and they had an income. And they're like, whoopee! You know, and there are a lot, you know, millions of people in the world who have been through, you know, lived in material poverty, deficits, deprivation, and then suddenly they have money. And, you know, it's hard to say, like, don't buy stuff. Like, well, you don't get to buy stuff, and there's like a billion of you. You know, but I don't want to stop buying stuff.
I think that just points to the fact that you have to go back to the beginning of the equation and make it circular again, so that, you know, we're not having to make a choice of whether we're buying a Snickers bar or not. It's, there's a candy bar with a disposable, biodegradable, whatever the answer is, wrapper.
Yeah.
And I can change my mood because I get some sugars on board, and I haven't hurt the environment.
Yeah, there's a design philosophy some people might be familiar with called cradle to cradle design, and you might want to look it up. I think I ordered one sample book up there, but these two guys got together about 20 years ago. One is a chemist, and one is an architect. And they both had this idea that things should all be in this circular materials economy. And they formed this sort of design consulting firm. And it's called Cradle to Cradle Design. So the idea is this thing is cradle to grave, right? But there should be no grave. There's no grave in nature. Like, the dead thing becomes the new live thing. It should go around and around and around and around. And I think of it because exactly the candy wrapper, one of the things they designed was an ice cream bar wrapper that was made of a material that apparently biodegraded or dissolved within like 48 hours of landing on the ground, and they embedded wildflower seeds in it. And so they said, eat more ice cream, and then just like take your ice cream wrapper off and like throw it away, and it makes the world better than it was before. It's not even less bad, it's more good. They're like, the tree, if it drops lots of petals, great, you know? So why are we the only ones who are making garbage that's bad? And then we have to like restrain ourselves and every day have these moral choices, like, should I buy the thing in that wrapper, or should I buy the thing in that wrapper? Should I get individually wrapped? Or, well, I could spend more to get a longer lasting thing, or less to get a shorter. It's like so much burden for us that, I mean, I'm not in the design field, but people who are, like, it really is such an impactful thing to be upstream and to think about different materials and different design that would prevent all this angst downstream, and to this, the decisions for like what we're at the end user supposed to do with everything, you know, to get 7 billion people to like, well, what am I supposed to do with this bag, or what am I supposed to do with this ice cream stick or something? What's the right place to put it? It's exhausting. People have other things, you know, or we have other emotional, political, family, job, stuff to worry about. And people are under stress. And to like think that we need to spend so much time like worrying about what we're going to do with our trash is burdensome. I mean, I'm glad that we take it on, you know, but it could be prevented through some better design and better systems. So, okay. So focusing on this, what do we do with our stuff that we've consumed? How do we best dispose of it? So, yes, increasing our diversion rate and having less go to landfill and more go to recycling and compost is great and fantastic. And if we can get all the way to zero waste, all the better. So right now, for example, San Francisco and Seattle and Portland are, I think, the top three in the country. And they're at about 80% diversion, all three of them. No, not right now. San Francisco, which I know best, has found other markets. So we're you know, like they're calling like, hey, Vietnam, can you, do you have some factories? Can you buy our stuff? And so they're so far finding other markets, but so far we're still doing this. But what's in that last 20%? You know, so we've got 80% out of the landfill, but what are we still sending to the landfill? What's in that last 20%? And audits of this remnant show that about half of it, about 10% more, is actually could go to compost or landfill, but was poorly sorted. People put it in the wrong bin. So could we address that through better education, through better signage, through, but you know what, there's a lot of tourists and people are busy and people are going to make mistakes and there's not perfect. So then they're working on sort of technology, you know, can we send the landfill stuff through some sort of machine that will sift out the rottables or, you know, magnet out the metals or whatever. So they're working on how to get the 10% that you still could compost or recycle out of this bunch that's going to landfill. And then there's 10% that is going to landfill. Why? It can't, stuff that cannot be composted or recycled.
Bags.
Packaging. And what else can't?
But you can't, like, get the thing off of the other thing. Like my almond, like my almond milk thing, where it's like, okay, it's metal on the inside, paper in the middle, and plastic on the outside.
Composite materials. So if it's plastic and paper, or paper and metal, or metal and plastic all like glued together and you can't take it apart, or it's a something that you can't get the screws out of the back and it says, do not open. And those things are designed for the dump. One-way track.
You know, but even, you know, light bulbs, batteries, some of those kinds of things, they don't belong to the dump either. Because
they don't belong to the dump.
Contaminate.
Right.
So there are some things that are really going to be a challenge on how we deal with them.
Yes. And some of those things are actually, they're not even on my chart. That's hazardous waste or household hazardous waste. And that should go to a special facility for special handling. But this is stuff that you are allowed to throw in your trash.
But people, you know, are throwing these things in their trash now because it's,
yes, they are.
You know, we've changed the technology in so many of these products in the last decade or so. And, you know, to get light bulbs that last 40 years and are brighter and everything else, use less electricity, there's rare metals in those products. And
true.
Contaminants.
Yeah.
And people aren't going to be thinking about that.
Right.
20 years from now when their bulbs finally go out.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of our clean tech now, like solar panels.
Yeah.
Solar panels, fantastic. And 30 years from now when everybody's solar panels are like failing, they're toxic waste. They're electronic waste. What are we going to do with that?
First Solar said that they would take them back and recycle 30 years in the future, and they're promising that today.
Cool.
Some companies. And so, but there, and there are, they are working on different solar technologies, but if you tell them ahead of time, extended producer responsibilities, you're going to have to take this back 30 years from now. They're going to think through how they design it. Are we going to weld stuff together, or are we going to put screws in? So that 30 years from now, we can go, zzz, 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 panel falls in half, zzz, 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 the components break apart, and we can sort it out by, this is copper, this is metal, this is silica, this is, or are we going to like seal it all with, you know, glue that we're going to have to pry apart? If you just let people make stuff and like send it out in the world and never going to take it back, they'll just glue it together. But if you say up front, think about how you're going to handle this when we ship them all back to you in 30 years, the design becomes different.
Have you heard about Fairphone in Europe? They do that. It's like a, it's a phone with like six pieces.
Modular phone.
It's made to be a cell phone that's made to be repairable, and they give YouTube videos.
Cool.
And of how the consumer can repair it themselves.
So you can pop it out and put in a different camera.
Yeah.
And then
I'm
something.
Not sure.
Yeah.
But there's not really a market here for it in the U.S., but some people have
could be
how to use it. So I'm hoping my phone lasts till then.
Could be. So in order to eliminate this section and make everything be able to go to compost or recycling, so basically, if we could do that, if we could make 100% of everything either be recyclable or compostable, then we would not have disposal, and we could greatly reduce extraction. And we would have production, distribution, consumption, or use, I'd like to say, use, and then back to production, distribution, use, production, distribution, use. This is recycling and compost. And you have the beginnings of a circular materials economy like nature, right? Circular. We eliminate the extraction and the disposal, and we just have this part. Woo! That could go on and on. Now, one of the things we have to think about is those materials. People talk about it in terms of... I usually have a whiteboard that goes like all the way across the whole thing. sometimes they call them metabolisms, or what do they call them if it's not a metabolism? Two cycles. The biological cycle, that is everything rottable. What kinds of materials could we ideally put in? For clothing, what could be in a biological cycle that gets grown and then
cotton,
wool,
flax.
Silk, flax, linen, rami, hemp, all of those, right? What about sort of like building materials? Wood. Not metal. Rot and regrow. Okay, so all of those, for example, straw. Yeah, you could have straw building material, straw belt, right? There's a technical metabolism, and this is the composting. Technical metabolism is recycling. So building materials could be
metal.
Glass.
Lead.
Yep. Copper. All sorts of metal. You know, aluminum and tin and glass. And,
concrete?
Yes.
Plastic.
And some plastic. Mm-hmm. So the idea is you could have materials made of those kinds of things if you can melt them down and make the same level of quality again. Melt it down, make the same level of quality. Melt it down, make it the same level of quality. That's true recycling. If you can melt it down once and make a lower quality thing like plastic lumber, you know, park benches or fleeces that came from milk bottles, it's one more life before it goes to the landfill or the incinerator, but it's actually downcycling because the quality isn't as high as it was last time. Once those the park benches or the lumber, the deck, whatever is made out of once-used plastic the second time, you can't make anything else out of it. It's already quite weak, and it's going to go to landfill now. True recycling is to be able to make the same quality thing over and over. So glass, you can do. Paper degrades. You can recycle it a few times, but the fibers get shorter and shorter, and so you always have to use some new fiber to make paper. But at the end, you could compost the fibers. So the trouble is when you mix these two, when you have cotton poly fabric, you can't put it in the compost bin and you can't melt it down to make new plastic. So now you have this problem. Or the soup boxes that have paper and metal and plastic all glued together. And this is this cradle-to-cradle design stuff. These things with mixed are called, I love it, monstrous hybrids.
That's where the Levitical law kicks in, isn't it?
Like, don't mix your fibers.
Mm-hmm.
Monstrous hybrids are a problem because while you took nice cotton and you took nice polyester fiber, but then you bound them together and you can't get them apart again. And so now that has to go to the landfill. That's part of the 10% remnant that you can't do anything with. So examples that So people are trying to design things that you could have both of these parts, but they have to come apart easily. So a winner of a student design contest for Cradle to Cradle a couple years ago designed a bike helmet where the outside was a single cast piece of aluminum, like aluminum shell, and it had cork inside and then some sort of hemp strap or something. Great. So use that. And then when you're done, you basically snap the cork out, throw the aluminum in aluminum recycling, cork goes to the biological cycle, your strap goes to the biological cycle, all done, right? There's not even glue, there's nothing, it was like molded to like snap in. Great. So that's a design that is for this circular economy. You can have metal and biological materials in the same thing. You could have glass and wood, but they have to snap apart. They have to be, you know, four screws, pop open. Don't glue stuff, don't have like lots of materials together. So this is a way that things could be so that that last 10% that has to go to the landfill. This is designed for disassembly, designed for reuse, designed for recycling, and it's not designed for the dump. Yeah.
So with all that in mind, what do we, like we're not the CEOs of the companies, so how
right.
do we make that this happen? Because there's still stuff out there. Like I even go to Trader Joe's and they have little packs, everything's like plastic packages that now can't recycle because we used to go to China and now can't.
Yeah.
I actually took a picture of their wall of plastic salads and all the stuff and I send it to, you know, I don't know, who, whatever, somebody at the
yeah.
time was like, can you repackage all this? But of course nobody...
Yeah, Trader Joe's is actually one of the worst.
Yeah.
It's one of the worst.
Nobody cares. You know, so I didn't like, how do we improve it?
Okay, good question, because, I mean, some people here might be designers or entrepreneurs or, you know, so do what you can on the design end. Those of us who buy stuff, you know, we can ask, we can look, and we can make some impact. The other thing, so, okay, so also. Okay, so, okay, production... distribution, consumption. This one is recycling and compost, where you melt stuff down, you rot it, and make a new thing. And I'll, okay, so I have to, what do you call that? A waiting table? What do we do? Parking lot. okay, I have to get there in a second. But another really important thing, this is just the baseline, this is like the last resort circular economy. It gets better. Because you don't have to go all the way back to the beginning and grind stuff down and melt it and regrow it. You can make your circle really short. This is reuse, repair, make it, you know, the use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without thing. So repair, learning to repair things. Oh, my videos are about to come out. Is the video, hey, okay. So in a second, we're gonna look at a little short video about Fix-It clinics. This is this pop-up thing where you can take your broken toaster, your broken electronic goods, or your vacuum cleaner, or whatever, to a Saturday thing, and there are people with funny little tools and they like to tinker and you take apart your toaster and try to figure out how to put it back together. And they have like a 72% success rate of people being to fix their own thing. So if you can make your toaster last another 5 years, then you prevent this whole cycle, right? Sewing cafes. A lot of people don't know how to sew anymore, but people are opening these sewing cafes where even people who don't have a sewing machine, but they're missing a button or their hem pulled out or whatever, can go buy a cup of coffee, and their cup of coffee gets them half an hour at a sewing machine. And people who hang out there who like to sew, and they can show them how to fix a seam or what, like getting some of these skills. And there's a cool thing called the Repair Manifesto. This repair movement, manifesto. If you look it up, it has like a dozen kind of statements about the value of repair. Like, repairing stuff makes it have more character. It does, you know, a pat, now it's yours. You know, repairing stuff gives you skills. Repairing stuff builds your connection with your object, and it isn't just something somebody made, but you like have this feeling for it. It there's all these like kind of cool inspirational reminders about the power of repair. There's also, so this is reuse and repair, reduce, maintain, like to carry your stuff. And then there's this from the user right back to distribution, like what would that be?
Craigslist,
Freecycle, Goodwill, pick and pull, auto parts, buying secondhand. It doesn't you don't have to grind up the t-shirt and put it through compost and grow a new cotton plant and da 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 da. If you can like hand me down or go buy a used shirt, or if your shirt wears out, then use it for a rag, or you know, buy or often this is an opportunity for what they call creative reuse. That is like art projects and interesting things. And you can enhance the value of stuff. There was somebody who has it. You know, Etsy is full of this, right? So there's somebody who takes old typewriters that are in junk lands and half the keys are missing, but they take the other keys off, the little round ones, you know, the little old from 100 years ago typewriters, they take the little round keys off and they make earrings out of them and jewelry and stuff. And so you have like, you know, P and Q hanging from the, and they're super cute. And so you can sell a pair of earrings for $30 that are made out of trash that was on a typewriter that you got for, you know, a dollar at the junk store. And then you can make 20 pairs of earrings out of it and like go on vacation with your, you know, so you're, we don't have to even send the typewriter all the way through the melting down process. Like we can bring it back into the cycle of material stuff, not having to like mine stuff out of a mountain in order to make earrings. You know, we can like get rid of the extraction and get rid of the disposal. And this circular economy gets like all these loopy things, right? So the errors in distribution could go back to product, but this one should be sort of like, when you can't do anything else with it, then melt it down again. But first, see if you can use it again. See if you can make something else out of it. See if somebody else can use it. See if you can fix it. See if you can, and keep it like this small. There are lots of benefits to reusing. We all know this. Reusing over recycling. Just for example, the glass pop bottles that we started with, you know, long time ago that they washed and refilled instead of melting down and making new glass bottles. How many degrees does it take to get boiling water so that you could sanitize bottles? How many, at what temperature does water boil? 212. How many degrees does it take to melt glass? About 2,000, 2,100-ish. So about 10 times as much energy to take a glass bottle, melt it down, and make a new glass bottle as to wash it. If you take a glass bottle and wash it 10 times, you've heated water to 212 10 times, or you've melted it down, made a new bottle, melt 10 times, you've used 100 times as much energy to recycle a bottle 10 times as to wash it and refill it 10 times. So recycling, I mean, and recycling has other, I'm for recycling. I want 100% diversion. That'd be great. The biological cycle and the technical cycle, get them going, totally use them, nothing to landfill, great. But to collect recycling, drive trucks, gather it, sort it, bale it, ship it, melt it, all the trucks, all the energy, all the sorting, all the, and then the melting, it's not like environmentally totally benign. Like that uses a ton of power to melt it down. Like fumes come off, pollutants go out from the recycling process itself. If you can keep it from recycling should be the last resort, right? So if we can make this circular economy circle a bunch before the thing has to get melted down again, all the better. It would save a ton of energy and a ton of pollution and stuff. Yeah.
It's under the repair part, it's also important to patronize companies that repair their stuff. For example, we had two 11-year-old Arc'teryx fleeces and 2 11-year-old Arc'teryx shells, and all the drawstrings fell out. We sent it back, and they repaired them free and sent it back. Patagonia does repairs.
REI.
REI. And so to pay attention where we buy stuff so that it can be repaired instead of landfilled.
Great. Yep. Great. I'll show you this clip, which is about the deconstruction. So the building industry is one of the largest amounts of waste materials, taking down buildings. We have developed a really quick way to do that with bulldozers and wrecking balls, but we lose all the materials, right? And there are financial, like bank loans, when a developer buys a old building and they want to build another one, they're given this really quick turnaround on loans, and they have to like get that old building gone as soon as possible, as I understand it. It's not my industry. But if we can change the rules somehow for banking, for financing, for taxes, which now they've done in California, you get tax incentives for salvaging materials from buildings. You can deconstruct a building instead of demolishing a building. And there's vast volumes of saleable, usable, valuable materials inside, and it's way more jobs. It only takes one person to run a bulldozer, and it takes lots of people crawling like ants over a building to take it apart, and it takes, you know, like 2 weeks instead of half a day. But jobs, money, materials, and all the, it's usually like high quality materials, like older wood, that, you know, old growth beams and stuff that you can't even get anymore. So here's a little snippet from Detroit. So there's lots of inspiring examples out there of ways to, you know, stop the linear flow directly to the landfill and bring things back in a circle. And there's one last concept I wanted to remember to tell you. Can I have the lights back on, please? And that is, we need to change the language in our heads. So there's this whole, the waste management industry. I mean, it's a huge industry. The whole thing, all the garbage companies, all the recycling companies, it's the waste management industry. What that does in our heads is say that there's this thing called waste, right? So we call this waste language. That is, there's this thing called waste. It's a noun. And there's piles of it. And we have to figure out how to manage it. What should we do with it? How to sort it? Where to put it? Should we burn it? Should we stuff it in the ground? How do we manage this pile of waste? So that in waste language, the construct is that the normal route is for waste to go to landfill or incineration. But if you're really good and you make special efforts, you can divert some of it to recycling or compost. But even the word diversion rate seems to imply that this is normal, and that's kind of like this off the side thing, like, oh, at the last second, you can like keep it out, right? Divert is like away from the main path. Instead, we can think of resource language. That is, we have these things called resources. We have our trees and our metals and our straw that grows, and we have our cotton, and we have our soil, and we have our resources. And then we use them, and when we're done with them, we have a choice. We could send them to landfill and incinerator, and that would be wasting them. That's a verb. And even though waste as a noun sounds kind of natural to, oh, what are you going to do with that? You know, it's in a waste can. What are we going to do with that waste? And it's sort of neutral. When we use waste as a verb, it still has a negative connotation, like, oh, don't waste that. Close the refrigerator door. You're wasting all the cold. Don't, you know, turn off the lights. You're wasting energy. Like, wasting as a verb still is a bad. And wasting our resources seems bad. And so we have a choice. Every time we throw something away, we can either waste it or not waste it, and we can have it go back to be a resource again. We can reuse, we can cycle, we can have it still be a resource. And so here's a choice. Every time we can either, so now I've taken, you know, we see people going to throw something in the trash can, and you're like, oh, are you going to waste that? Like, I see you throwing an aluminum can in the trash. Like, are you choosing to waste that? You know, why are you wasting our resources? At least put it in the recycling, you know? So just the first time I heard, like, the difference between waste as a noun, like it's a pile of problem waiting to be, you know, go to the landfill, versus wasting as a verb of our noun resources. It's like, you know, it's a shift. And so really, when you think about it like that, like this needs to be really eliminated and build this up. And if we can have the biological cycle of materials and the technical cycle of materials and no monstrous hybrids and keep things as close to our end of the circular economy as possible, reuse, repair, give it to a friend, hand me down, maintain, and then, or, you know, secondhand, give it to Goodwill, repair, resell, Craigslist, something. And then if it really doesn't work anymore, then it's recyclable or compostable. Then we have a fully circular economy like nature. And we won't have this pile of stuff that we've made into trash that started out as our beautiful resources. The end.